The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Today, I'd like to talk to you about the relationship of faith and reason, drawing on work from my book, Is Belief Believable? I'm going to tell you five different stories. The first is the story that all religions are paths up the same mountain. The second story is of the blind men and the elephant. The third, the story of the hiddenness of God. The fourth story is about a Chinese farmer. And the last story is a true story about my gay father-in-law. The story that all religions are paths up the same mountain might be summarized by the words of Ramakrishna. Once upon a time, God has made different religions to suit different aspirations, times, and countries. All doctrines are so many paths, but a path is by no means God himself. Indeed, one can reach God if one follows any of the paths with wholehearted devotion. One may eat a cake with icing, either straight or sideways. It will taste sweet either way. As one and the same material water is called by different names, so too the one everlasting intelligent bliss is invoked by some as God, by some as Allah, by some as Jehovah, and by others as Brahman. As one can ascend to the top of a house by means of a ladder or a bamboo or a staircase or a rope, so diverse are the ways and means to approach God, and every religion in the world shows one of these ways. So concludes the story that all religions are paths up the same mountain. Stephen Protero, professor of religion at Boston University, doesn't agree. In his book, God is Not One, Protero points out, the world's religious rivals do converge when it comes to ethics. No religion tells you it's okay to have sex with your mother or to murder your brother. But they diverge sharply on doctrine, ritual, mythology, experience, and law. Why is there this divergence? Protero answers that different religions attempt to solve different problems. In Judaism, the problem is exile, and the solution is return to God. In Buddhism, the problem is suffering, and the solution is awakening. In Confucianism, the problem is chaos, and the solution is order. In Christianity, the problem is sin, and the solution is salvation. In Islam, the problem is pride, and the solution is submission. As Protero put it, if practitioners of the world's religions are mountain climbers, then they are ascending very different peaks using very different tools. The mountain analogy makes sense if we reduce religion to ethics, as followers of Immanuel Kant do. But is religion essentially reducible to ethics? If I tell a Muslim woman that her religion essentially agrees with Catholicism and with Buddhism and with Hinduism, her rightful response to me could be, how exactly do you know more about my religion than I do? Have you ever visited Mecca? Have you ever read the Quran in Arabic? It seems presumptuous to tell others what is non-essential about their own religion. Protero calls the mountain analogy into question in another way. He writes, to claim that all religions are one, therefore, is simply to claim that debates about whether we have souls, yes, say Christians, no, say Buddhists, or whether God has a body, yes, say Mormons, no, say Muslims, do not really matter. Because, as the Hindu teacher Swami Sivananda writes, The fundamentals or essentials of all religions are the same. There is difference only in non-essentials. This claim is as odd as it is intriguing. We accept as self-evident that competing economic systems, capitalist or communist, and clashing political parties, Republican or Democrat, propose very different solutions to our planet's problems. Yet, when it comes to religion, we jump eagerly down the rabbit hole into a fantasy world in which, like children in Garrison Keillor's Lake Wobegon, all religions are above average. If Protero is right, the view that our religions are the same in essentials is itself an expression of one particular religion. The mountain analogy reflects Hindu doctrine. Hindus teach that beneath the perception of difference, all reality is really one, Brahman, the absolute. Rather than reducing religion to ethics, this Hindu view reduces religion, indeed all reality, to a metaphysical monism. For reasons I've talked about elsewhere, monism is hard to believe. In his book, Telling a Better Story, How to Talk About God in a Skeptical Age, Joshua Chatra draws yet another problem for the mountain analogy. He writes, "People who hold that all religions are basically the same perspective under a mantle of inclusivity and tolerance actually engage in a form of progressive colonialism that runs over the views that they don't find palatable. It's as if they've placed themselves on top of a mountain, with truth in hand, looking down on myopic religious adherents scrambling up their intolerant one way. The problem isn't that they think others are wrong and they are right. We all do that. The problem is that this view is often helped because it is thought to be more tolerant than those views which make exclusive claims, all the while making its own exclusive claim." In other words, the person at the top of the mountain is making an exclusive claim about religion just as much as those lower down the mountain. As Timothy Keller notes, "How could you possibly know that no religion can see the whole truth unless you yourself have the superior comprehensive knowledge of spiritual reality you just claimed none of the religions have?" Some people advocate the mountain analogy because they want to promote toleration among people of different faiths. I share this laudable goal, and so does Protero. He writes, "I too hope for a world in which human beings can get along with their religious rivals. I'm convinced, however, that we must pursue this goal through more realistic means. Rather than beginning with a sort of godthink that lumps all religions together into one trash can or one treasure chest, we must start with a clear-eyed understanding of the fundamental differences between Judaism and Islam, Buddhism and Hinduism, Taoism and Confucianism. I think it's a mistake to think we must choose between toleration and truth. In fact, truth is the proper foundation of toleration. If we accept the truth that every human being has unconditional dignity, then we have a sound foundation for toleration of every human being. We ought not to pit toleration against truth or truth against love." The philosopher and Holocaust victim Edith Stein teaches us, "Do not accept anything as the truth if it lacks love. Do not accept anything as love which lacks truth." Thomas Aquinas explains the metaphysical basis for the unity of truth and love. If God is truth, and if God is love, then love and truth must always go together, since they are united in the deepest way in God. Aquinas saw the perfect unity of truth in love in the person of Jesus. Jesus calls us not just to tolerate, but to love people of every creed, color, class, and culture. But Jesus did not teach that there are many paths of the mountain. Jesus taught, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And now a second story. Once upon a time, a blind man put out his hand and touched the side of the elephant. "How smooth! An elephant is like a wall." A second blind man put out his hand and touched the trunk of an elephant. "How round! An elephant is like a snake." The third blind man put out his hand and touched the tusk of the elephant. How sharp! An elephant is like a spear. The fourth blind man put out his hand and touched the leg of an elephant. How tall! An elephant's like a tree. The fifth blind man reached out his hand and touched the ear of the elephant. How wide! An elephant is like a fan. The sixth blind man put out his hand and touched the tail of the elephant. How thin! An elephant is like a rope. An argument ensued, each blind man thinking his own perception of the elephant was the correct one. The Raja, awakened by the commotion, called out from the balcony. "The elephant is a big animal," he said. "Each one of you touched only one part. You must put all the parts together to find out what an elephant is like." Enlightened by the Raja's wisdom, the blind men reached agreement. "Each one of us knows only a part. To find out the whole truth, we must put the parts together." Now, what does this story mean? According to one interpretation of this story, the various perspectives people offer about ultimate questions are just so many partial experiences that only capture a part of the divine mystery. Human beings seeking to understand the transcendent are like blind men. No one has the full truth. Every perspective is partial. Only the Raja, whose father rules the kingdom, sees the whole elephant and enlightens those who accept his perspective. What would St. Thomas Aquinas say about the story of the blind men and the elephant? He would agree that no one has the full truth about God except God alone. Only a divine mind can fully comprehend the divine essence, for only an infinite divine understanding can be comprehensively united with an infinite divine reality. Even for those in heaven, God remains utterly transcendent, beyond comprehensive human understanding, for those in heaven still have finite minds. For those on earth, the transcendent is even more mysterious. As St. Paul wrote, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know, even as I am known." Human beings cannot fully know the mystery of God. "If I knew God, I would be God," as a medieval Hebrew saying put it. But what about the Raja? He has sight, so he knows the truth about the elephant. His vision of the elephant transcends the partial, fragmentary understanding of the blind men, who can only touch parts of the elephant. So at least the Raja knows the truth about the divine mystery. But this is a problem for the parable of the blind men and the elephant. As Timothy Keller notes, the only way you could possibly know that every religion only sees part of the truth is if you assume you see all the truth. So at its heart, the elephant analogy is self-defeating. In his book, The Reason for God, Keller sums up the contradiction inherent in this ancient story. How could you know that each blind man only sees part of the elephant unless you claim to be able to see the whole elephant? In other words, how could you possibly know that no religion can see the whole truth unless you yourself have the superior, comprehensive knowledge of spiritual reality you just claim that none of the religions have? Indeed, if the Raja is merely human, how can the Raja transcend the limitations of human experience? He cannot. No one who is merely human can go beyond the limitations of being human. If the Raja is merely human, then he must share in the partial and limited human perspective, and thus he would be just one more blind man. But what if the divine reality became a human reality? What if God was one of us? Well, if this happened, this human being could know more about God than would ever be possible for a mere human being. This human being could transcend the limitations of human reasoning and finite experience, since this human being would be not only human, but also divine. That is, of course, precisely what Jesus of Nazareth claimed. He said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." He said, "I and God the Father are one." He's the one who said, "Whoever has seen me has seen the Father." Jesus, the Prince of Peace, claimed the insight of the Raja in the parable when he said, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." If Jesus is God, then Jesus can accurately tell us about the divine mystery. To find out the whole truth of the divine mystery, God must put all the parts together for us. Indeed, if Jesus is God, he can give sight to blind men. Thus, the parable of the blind men and the elephant leads either to contradiction or to Christ. A third story I'd like to tell you today comes from a movie, The Man with Two Brains. Steve Martin plays a widower who is considering getting remarried. His beautiful but greedy girlfriend, Dolores, artfully conceals her cruelty. One day, Martin stands before a portrait of his dead first wife, Rebecca, and he begs, "Rebecca, if there's anything wrong with my feelings for Dolores, just give me a sign." Immediately, lights blink, winds whip, and an earthquake erupts. The portrait spins in circles on the wall, and Rebecca's voice from beyond the grave cries out louder and louder, "No, no, no." And then, after 15 seconds or so, it all stops. Martin, disheveled by the winds, looks at the off-kilter portrait, and he says, "Just any kind of sign. I'll keep on the lookout for it." In Existentialism is a Humanism, Jean-Paul Sartre noted, "It is I myself in every case who have to interpret the signs." This insight holds true also when looking for signs from God. If spectacular golden letters appeared in the sky spelling out, "I am the God of Abraham, believe in me," would this sign bring people to a relationship with God? Golden letters in the sky couldn't exactly prove that God exists, because presumably a powerful alien or even a swarm of drones could make those letters appear in the sky. The atheist philosopher A.J. Ayer had a near-death experience and wrote, "I was confronted by a red light, exceedingly bright, and also very painful, even when I turned away from it. I was aware that this light was responsible for the government of the universe." But this sign did not dislodge his atheism. Why not? As Peter Harrison pointed out in his book, Some New World, what we see is at least partially determined by what we already believe. So it's not the case that the supernatural is no longer directly experienced, but rather that what we experience is no longer labeled supernatural. Scientists call this predictive processing. What we believe, what we think, what we seek shapes what we see. In an online video called The Monkey Business Illusion, people are asked to count how many times players wearing white shirts pass a basketball as they move among players in black shirts passing another basketball. In the midst of all this action, a person wearing a gorilla costume walks through the players. About half the people watching the video don't see the gorilla. We can have eyes but not see. Moreover, if Jews, Christians, and Muslims are right, God is a spiritual being, not a material object like a gorilla. We cannot see God as we see molecules under a microscope or stars in the night sky. Indeed, the hiddenness of God is itself a biblical teaching. Isaiah says, "Truly, you are a God who hides yourself." God hides his face from Moses, saying, "You cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live." But although hidden from direct sight, Christians believe God does disclose himself. As Father Kevin Grove put it, God's revelation is often enough discoverable under the meekest signs of its opposite. The helpless baby born in a stable to a mother without means is really a king. The convicted criminal dying on a cross is actually the ultimate judge and Lord of life. God is hidden in the sacraments, hidden in the scriptures, and hidden in the discouraged, the bedraggled, and the addicted. As Gerard Manley Hopkins wrote, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God." According to St. Thomas Aquinas, the hiddenness of God does not last forever. Those in heaven do see God face to face. Seeing God is enjoying eternal happiness. So why is this vision of God reserved for the life to come? In chapter 8 of the Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis points out that if God were to make himself irresistible and indisputable, this would override the human ability to choose whether or not to love God. If we are to be free to choose to love or not to love God, then God cannot appear to us face to face in overwhelming power and majesty. For this reason, God chooses to woo, not compel, to be delicate rather than overwhelming. Jesus himself suggested that miraculous signs have limited value in bringing people to God. If they do not believe, hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead, he said. Maybe we find God, if we find God at all, in everyday life. Maybe, if you're looking for a sign to seek God, this is it. A fourth story is about a widowed Chinese farmer. A farmer and his only son labored through the cold winds of winter and the scorching rays of summer with their last remaining horse. One day, the son didn't lock the gate of the stable properly, and the horse bolted away. When neighbors learned what happened, they came to the farmer and said, "What a sadness this is. Without your horse, you'll be unable to maintain the farm. What a failure that your son did not lock the gate properly. This is a great tragedy." The farmer replied, "Maybe yes, maybe no." The next day, the missing horse returned to the farmer's stable, bringing along with it 6 wild horses. The farmer's son locked the gate of the stable firmly behind all 7 horses. When neighbors learned what happened, they came to the farmer and said, "What happiness this brings. With 7 horses, you'll be able to maintain the farm with 3 of them and sell the rest for huge profits. What a blessing." The farmer replied, "Maybe yes, maybe no." The next day, the farmer's son was breaking in one of the wild horses. The son got thrown from the horse, fell hard on rocks, and broke his leg. When neighbors learned what happened, they came to the farmer and said, "What a great sadness this is. Now you'll be unable to count on your son's help. What a shame to have a broken leg. What a tragedy." The farmer replied, "Maybe yes, maybe no." Well, the very next day, a general from the Imperial Chinese Army arrived to conscript all the young men in the village into the army. Their assignment was to fight on the front lines of a battle against a terrifying enemy of overwhelming force. The farmer's son, because of his broken leg, was not taken. When the neighbors learned what happened, they came to the farmer, and they said, "What great joy! Your son avoided facing certain death on the front lines of battle. What a blessing!" And then the farmer replied, "Maybe yes, maybe no." What does this story mean? The story of the Chinese farmer teaches us vital lessons about the problem of evil. The story teaches us to suspend judgment about what appears to be a tragedy or a triumph. Can we really always tell what is fortunate and what is unlucky? Sometimes the wiser course of action is to withhold judgment rather than definitively declare that what happens is good or bad. A Stoic philosopher like Epictetus would see the story as portraying the farmer's rightful detachment from what is not in his control, matters about which he should be indifferent. Epictetus taught, "There are things within our power and there are things which are beyond our power." Losing his horse, gaining new horses, his son's broken leg, and his son's avoiding deadly combat are all matters that are not within the farmer's power to control. In this Stoic view, the farmer is wise in not letting these external matters disturb him. The farmer seems to have gotten what is asked for in the Serenity Prayer. "God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." But perhaps the story teaches us that what appears to be bad initially may ultimately be a means to a blessing. Our immediate vision is not always 20/20. How often has something that seemed like a major setback or even a tragedy turned out to be the beginning of something great? Do we not often see only in hindsight that a difficulty was just what we needed to grow and flourish in the long term? Painful and challenging experiences often lead to development, especially when reframed as opportunities to learn, to grow in skills, in virtue, and in bonds. The story of the Chinese farmer may also teach us about the complicated relationship between suffering and well-being. Sometimes what is indeed bad, breaking a leg, can lead to something good, avoiding death in battle. And yet what is bad remains bad even if something good comes from it. It's always bad when an attempted murder takes place, yet in some cases an attempted murder leads to something good, such as a serial killer finally getting arrested. Similarly, what is good remains good even if something bad comes from it. It's good for a husband and wife to have a child, even if years later it's bad that the child becomes a criminal. Moreover, the story of the Chinese farmer teaches us something about what we ultimately consider good and evil amid the vicissitudes of lesser goods and evils in life. For people of faith, the ultimate good is enjoying perfect love, perfect goodness, and perfect beauty forever. This is called heaven, the community of those who love each other and God perfectly. The ultimate evil is eternal self-willed loneliness, a heart forever divided against itself, a will ever frustrated in seeking the good. In the Inferno, Dante imagined the fate of the worst lost souls in the lowest circle of hell. They are in the coldest and smallest prison cell imaginable, totally encapsulated in ice, isolated from each other, and lacking even in the smallest freedom. The ice is made by Satan, who cries tears of frustration as he flaps his great wings, struggling in vain to free himself from the ice. Satan's vain, tearful struggle against God only creates more and more ice, increasing his imprisonment. A great French novelist once wrote, "The only real tragedy, the only real failure, the only great tragedy in life is not to become a saint." If so, then the only perfect happiness, the only ultimate success, the greatest blessing in life, is to become a saint. Someday, will you and I enjoy the perfect happiness of the saints? Maybe yes, maybe no. The final story I want to talk about is a true story. My father-in-law, Dennis, came out as gay and left the Catholic Church in about 1971. As my wife, Jennifer, grew up, her relationship with her dad was rocky. They saw each other rarely because she lived on the West Coast and he lived on the East Coast. But when they did get together, sparks often flew. He would snap at her if she said or did anything that contradicted his own perspective. But prickly personalities and religious differences need not destroy the love of a family. Jennifer took "honor thy father" not as a suggestion but as a commandment. So she made enormous efforts to cultivate a good relationship with her father. Every time Jen spoke with him on the phone, her face was braced for trouble, her voice tensed up, and her every word was picked with the deliberation of a diplomat. Since he lived in New York and we lived in Los Angeles, we didn't see him too often. However, that changed when we moved for a fellowship year to Princeton. We would travel to New York City every 3 weeks or so to visit with Dennis and his legal husband, Claudio. We kept it light and focused on common interests. We never talked about religion unless they brought it up. We knew where they stood and they knew where we stood. But as the year went on, Dennis became more and more ill. It became clear that death would visit him soon. So, on our final visit to New York City, we all knew that this would be the last time we would ever see each other. Jen and I were heading back from Princeton to Los Angeles, and Dennis was moving to Claudio's home country of Uruguay. They gave us a few mementos to pack in our car, and they walked us out to the sidewalk to see us off. When I said goodbye to Claudio, he told me, "You know, Chris, I was terrified to meet you. I'm an atheist, a Jew, and gay, so I thought you'd hate me, but you've never been anything but loving and kind to me." On his cheek, I gave Dennis a kiss goodbye. Tears filled my eyes as Jennifer and her dad embraced in their final farewell. So Dennis and Claudio moved to Uruguay, and Jennifer and I moved back to Los Angeles. but Jennifer kept in regular contact with her dad on the phone. A nurse who cared for him gave us updates. Within months of the move, the nurse told us that Dennis would be dead within days. I asked Jen, should we try to see if your dad would allow a priest to give him last rites? She said she would see if he was open to it, so she called and talked to him. But Dennis didn't think he was dying, so there was no need at all, he thought, for last rites. Well, would he be open to a priest coming to pray with him, to give him the anointing of the sick? Yes, he'd do that. So I reached out to a priest friend in Los Angeles, Father Paul Donlin, who connected me with another priest living in Uruguay. This priest rushed over to visit my father-in-law. The priest heard Dennis's confession, his first in 50 years, administered last rites, and gave him viaticum, his final Holy Communion. In the last picture we have of Dennis, just days before he died, he looks totally exhausted. In his emaciated hand, he holds a crucifix the priest had given to him. The nurse told my wife that he wouldn't let go of it. She washed his hands around the crucifix. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.